The title of tonight's talk is The Art of No Clinging. And I'd like to speak about the theme that in Pali is called Anupada Vimoka, liberation through non-clinging, or freedom as our mind's true nature. I'd like to approach this as an investigation of freedom and consider first, what is your sense? Your felt sense of clinging. Too loud? Finally less? Sometimes we want more. Sometimes we want less. Okay, we'll see. Could you adjust it as I speak so that it gets right? And then just say less or more and she'll fix it for you on the sober test. So I'd like you to have a reflection. It's okay. Have a reflection on what is your felt sense of clinging. Because clinging as a concept is something we talk about, but we're never going to be freed through a concept. We need to investigate how do we actually experience clinging? What does it feel like to cling? Imagine a moment when you're grasping something, when you're attached to something, when you're holding to something, when you're wanting or not wanting. Then we're clinging. Think of something that you were grasping today, that you were wanting or not wanting. And remember that feeling. And what does it feel like to not cling, to let go, to release? When we tune into the feeling of clinging, we very often feel things like tension or contraction, tightness or rigidity, or a kind of brittle quality to the mind, a weakness. This contraction, recognizing it, serves as a reminder, because when we recognize the clinging, we are reminded that we have the possibility of not clinging. Whenever we recognize that we're doing something, we have the possibility to cease doing it, to stop doing it. Release can be so simple, to know our experience without grasping it, without clinging. We don't need to justify our suffering. We don't need to get to the bottom of the past causes for our feelings, for our emotions, for our pain, for our drama. When we feel the way that we might be clinging to our own dramas, our own stories, our own issues, our own pains, then it's almost like we're holding a hot coal. And it doesn't take a lot of investigation and thought to let it go. When we recognize the suffering of it, the dukkha of it, we let it go. When we recognize the contraction and the tension of attachment, we let it go. Clinging causes suffering. And as a strategy, it never has worked to make us happy. We may want something. We may want to be happy. So we see something that we desire and we try to grasp it. The problem is it's never worked, or we would all be happy and we would not have come to this retreat. Clinging can appear to be a concept, one of those Buddhist concepts, one of those things you never hear about unless you go on a retreat. But when we feel this contraction in our hearts and in our minds, the way we contract around a pain rather than just feel a pain, the way we constrict around a wave of grief rather than just allow that sadness to pass through us, the way that we judge ourselves for feeling envy or jealousy rather than just allow that feeling to arise and pass without any trace. Sometimes we can feel craving, and it's almost like suffocating us. This extra feeling of the suffocation, of the constriction, of the tightness is the craving, is the clinging. The Buddha taught what are called the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is there is suffering. Well, in all my groups today, there was suffering described. So although I didn't sit in on Leela's and Eran's, I have a feeling that suffering was described in theirs too. I think at this point in the retreat, you all know that there is suffering. There are things that are unpleasant, and they come with the body, and they come with the mind, and they come with conditioned phenomena. There is a quality that is unreliable, undependable, and not the way we want it to be. That comes with life. That's part of the first noble truth. The second noble truth was an inquiry into suffering. The first is suffering must be known. The second noble truth explores the cause of suffering and what do we do with that cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is craving, and craving must be abandoned. This is the second noble truth. I like the illustration of holding a fistful of sand. Imagine picking up a fistful of sand and squeezing it. The tighter we squeeze, the more of it we lose. Can we instead hold the events of our own lives quite lightly with an open hand? Hold our stuff, our stories, our histories, our aims, our intentions with a light hand. What we practice is the art of not clinging. We are not really practicing Buddhism. We are not practicing Vipassana. We're not practicing Zen or Advaita or all the various schools of thought. Again and again, we're returning to the simple practice of not grasping. And practice is remembering this, to remember not clinging, to reconnect with this natural and open way of being in the world. In the 10th century in India, there was a university called Nalanda University, which was a Buddhist university. And there was an abbot named Naropa who was held this prestigious role as abbot. But he left that role because he was seeking his true guru, who he finally met one day. His name was Tilopa. And upon meeting Tilopa, Tilopa asked him a question. What do you seek? And Naropa responded, I seek the freedom of enlightenment. It's a great answer. And that dialogue went on. And from what do you wish to be free? From everything. And Tilopa said, it is not outer objects that bind and entangle you. It is clinging that binds you. Simply relinquish clinging and be free. The freedom of enlightenment is as simple as this, to relinquish clinging. You don't actually have to dig up all of your personal issues and solve them all. You don't have to come to a conclusion and a solution regarding all of your relationship issues. You don't have to succeed. You don't have to get what you want. You don't have to eliminate the pain in your body. You don't have to overcome fatigue. You don't even have to have perfect health. You don't need to gain a great deal of knowledge. You don't need to know all the Buddhist lists. Simply relinquish clinging and be free. The practice of not clinging was taught 2,600 years ago. It's the essence of the Buddhist teaching, and it is not very complicated. Sometimes we think we need more sophisticated techniques for our technological age. And actually, it's quite fun to learn various meditation techniques. So I don't discourage it. I encourage it. But I don't think there's anything flawed or missing about the basic technique, which is simply to let go of all forms of attachment. Whenever we find the mind clinging, to release that clinging and experience the mind, know the mind as it is not clinging, as it is not grasping, when it is not attached. Do you ever wonder why we continue to cling even after just speaking about the technological age. Do you ever wonder why we continue to cling even after we know that clinging causes suffering, even after we feel the pain of that contraction? I think a big part of it is that we're not yet perceiving impermanence with clarity. Is anyone here exactly the same as they were yesterday? Now, you must have lost a hair or grown a something or other or changed a mental state. Do you have the same feelings that you had an hour ago? Do you have the same thoughts you had 5 minutes ago? Do you even have the same cells in your body that you had several years ago? Is the weather today the same as it was yesterday? Have you had any experience in your entire life that didn't change? Do you know anyone who's not changed? Oh, okay. The same addiction for 30 years? Headache. The exact same headache. It's never increased. It's never decreased. Okay. Now, this is an important point about change. Is in the... change can, we often use the word impermanence, and some people translate a Nietzsche more precisely to have two aspects, the aspect of impermanence and the aspect of inconstancy. So there's the impermanence where it begins and it ends. So there's a beginning and an ending. And it may begin and end and begin and end and begin and end many times. And yet there are discrete beginnings and endings. It could be between waking and sleeping. It could be from one moment to another. It could be from one day to the next. There is also the quality of impermanence that notices change within an experience or within a concept. So say we say a pain. Then within the duration of that pain, we notice, or maybe pain is too big a concept, say pressure. We say, I've had this pressure for the last 10 minutes. Well, have we actually had that exact same pressure for the last 10 minutes? Or has the intensity increased or decreased? When we look into the aspect of impermanence with clarity and mindfulness, and we refine the attention, we notice the beginnings and the endings. We notice the beginning of the breath and the ending of the breath. And we notice how experience changes through the duration of the breath. So we're exploring these different aspects of impermanence. All of our conditioned experience changes. There are moments of beginnings, moments of endings. Moments when things appear, when they disappear, when they increase, and when they decrease. But even though we've all experienced change, it sometimes seems as though we haven't quite learned that lesson. We haven't quite noticed it. Our own experience tells us that everything changes. And yet, we often don't recognize this simple fact. In those moments when you do notice change, what is the quality of your mind? What is the quality of a mind that notices change? Most people find that as they observe the mind noticing change, that the mind itself is not suffering, even if they're noticing a painful situation. I used to teach a pain class using meditation techniques to work with chronic pain. And so most of the students in the class had quite severe medical issues that had strong pain. And so we would do a mindfulness practice where I would have them actually observe the pain. And we would do it in dyads, in pairs. So two people would sit facing each other. And I would ask them to first, they would first get some skill doing the meditation practice we've done for the last 2 days of just feeling the breath and learning to calm the mind. And then when the mind was calm, we would turn the attention to the pain itself. And I would ask them to notice it and to use a technique similar to the mental noting technique that's taught in the Mahasi Sayadaw method, where we note the pain. For instance, say I was sitting with a partner. My partner would just be listening to me. And I would basically be meditating out loud. Instead of silently noting the various changing sensations, I would describe them. So I would sit, feel a few breaths, and then I would move the attention to the area of pain. And I would describe pulsing, pulsing, pulling, pulling, stronger, hard, harder, harder, tight, tight, fear, fear, not liking, sharp, 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 throbbing, tingling, tingling, wanting, wanting, not wanting, wanting, thinking, judging, pulling, 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 softening, expanding. It's like that, where the mind goes right into the pain and just describes word by word how one attends to it. So very often you heard me describing the physical sensations that I was experiencing, moment by moment as the mind lands, sometimes on a sharpness and sometimes on a pulling, sometimes on a throbbing. But periodically the mind comes in and says, ick, I don't like that, or I want something else, or judging it. And so there's this interaction between mind and body. And so we would do this in the class. It would be a way of helping them learn some basic meditation techniques when the mind was in a fairly strong state of contraction. And what would happen is in a very short time, we might do it for 15 minutes or something, and then discuss the experience. And virtually everybody, when I asked them what their state of mind was as they were noticing the pain, they described peace. They described tranquility. They described equanimity and spaciousness. And peace was probably... Does it look right? Peace was probably the most common description that would come up in all of those pain classes. And I found that to be of extraordinary value, because meditation doesn't take our pain away. But if it can create a peaceful relationship to chronic pain, the suffering in life is tremendously decreased. And meditation can do that. Awareness can do that. Mindfulness does do that. It creates a peaceful and clear relationship to whatever is happening, even if it is sharp burning sensations. So in meditation practice, we're training ourselves to observe not only what is arising the pain, but also what happens to it as we notice it. So we're training ourselves to observe change, the flow of pleasant experience and unpleasant experience. As the Buddha said, whatever feelings arise, we abide contemplating the impermanence of those feelings. He also said, what is impermanent is not worth holding to. Generosity, in Pali the term is dana, is traditionally one of the primary expressions and training grounds for not clinging. Because when we give, our hand is open. We're not clinging. We're not grasping. It's as though the fistful of sand is held very lightly and shared with all. So learning to give is one of the primary trainings in the Buddhist practice. When I lived in the monasteries in Thailand, we would offer food to the monks each morning. And I would often stand in line for many hours for the opportunity and privilege to give, to offer food. Many times I would look around at the people who were in line with me, sometimes wealthy bankers from Bangkok or colonels taking some time to come to the monastery. But very often they were very poor village women who had come to offer the best of their meager resources. And I was always struck by the extraordinary joy on the faces of everybody who gave, banker, colonel, and villager alike. Too often I find that joy, that delight in giving, missing from our flagrantly wealthy Western cultures. Too often when we have greater wealth, we tend to protect it a little more than we might need to, looking out for number one, holding on to whatever we have, and then sometimes giving only out of guilt or out of obligation. It's no surprise to me that although technology has brought us tremendous achievements, it has not succeeded in bringing us the simple joy, the simple delight, and the quality of deep happiness that I saw on the faces and in the hearts of those poor village women in Thailand who would go to the monastery each morning and offer food to the monks. In the context of retreat practice, we don't interact very much, so it seems as though there are few opportunities to practice giving, to practice generosity. But actually there are. Even today, there were several times when somebody held the door open for me. There are times when we just make a little space for each other, when we just sense or see somebody needs a little space or a little something without eye contact. There's just an allowance, a tolerance, a sense of courtesy for each other, a sense of caring for each other. You may be standing in line to put your dishes in that circulating dishwasher, and see that the person behind you just has one little soup bowl and they're waiting behind five or six people. And you just, without making eye contact, just gently take their soup bowl and let them go on their way and you put it in the tray. These little acts of generosity are yogi, the work period that you do is an act of generosity. Not just doing it because you have to do your little work here, but actually making it an offering, it, making it a giving. If you're cleaning the toilets, clean them really well. You know, clean the little handles, clean under the seat. Do it as a gift. Do it as an offering. The food that we receive, that the cooks have prepared, and that different people have helped to chop, is an offering of so many people. We can accept that as an offering, and we can engage in each of our little roles in the spirit of generosity. It's that spirit that fills the heart with joy and with delight. In Buddhist cultures, it's understood that this kind of training in generosity creates a force of virtue. That is what makes meditation, gladness, and concentration possible. In Thailand, they call it merit. In Pali, panya. It's a term that we tend to not like in the West because it brings the image of karmic brownie points, as though there's some kind of heavenly bank account that each little good deed we do gets sort of chalked up in. But I don't think punya is like that. However, I do believe that an enormous force of virtue, of merit, is actually needed to be able to know the mind of no clinging in a sustained and ongoing way, to actually stabilize the little glimpses and insights that we all have. Many of you have had and will have more insights into the nature of things. Do you ever wonder what makes the difference between an insight just coming and going and an insight actually changing your life? Concentration helps a lot because we deepen that experience. But what makes it possible to concentrate the mind? What makes it possible to stabilize the mind? I think there is a lot to this force of virtue, this force of merit. To add a level of purity and a level of strength to our practice. And I found two qualities in particular, generosity and mindfulness, to be the two most powerful means that I know of generating this force. This force of virtue is something that we can actually sense, even if we cannot quite measure it in neat accounting columns. We can feel that strength growing within us, a strength of purity, a strength of delight. And when we're in a tough spot in our practice, when we feel like we're in an uphill battle, when things are really hard and we're tired and we feel like all the hindrances are attacking us all at once, that's the time when our force of virtue becomes a tremendous resource and strength, a great refuge for us. It's this force of virtue that helps us, like pushing a boulder up the hill sometimes when we're faced with a bunch of hindrances. But we have to keep going. We have to keep going. And we get the strength to keep going and to keep going through the accumulated energy that comes through the accumulation of our mindfulness and the accumulation of our virtue and our generosity. This force of virtue may also be one of the conditions that make it, that support our remembering to be mindful. Do you ever wonder why you come here, you walk in the room completely intent on being mindful? And then sometimes the mind wanders, and sometimes you remember to be mindful, and then it wanders again, and you remember to be mindful. And you wonder, well, what makes that moment of remembering to be mindful? Well, there are lots of conditions that come together in our practice. But one aspect of that is this purity of mind, is this force of virtue that helps us and strengthens the capacity to remember to be mindful. So concentration, joy, generosity, virtue, and ease are all linked together. Non-generosity, confusion, clinging, grasping, tension, suffering are also linked. If our minds are contracted, tight around wanting something, holding something, then not only is the letting go of generosity difficult, but the joy and stability of a concentrated mind is inaccessible. Throughout the Buddhist teachings, generosity is considered the prerequisite to the development of mind and concentration. This is not so difficult to imagine because the practice of dana cultivates the capacity to trust, to release, to let go, to appreciate, to care. It's a training in not clinging. So what do we cling? The Buddha said there were four primary kinds of clinging, four arenas for clinging. The first is the clinging to sense pleasures. There are sense pleasures, views and opinions, rites and rituals, conventions, and clinging to a concept of self. So I'd like to first speak about clinging to sense pleasures. This is the arena for clinging in our own relationship to our senses and our perceptions. It includes anything. We could cling lovely scents of the flowers, or delicious tastes at the meals, or tactile sensations of warmth and softness. We might cling beautiful appearances, the sunset, the moon. We might also cling states of meditation, calmness, tranquility, maybe even a little bliss and ecstasy. Whatever you consider to be a good meditation could be something that becomes a state that you then cling as a sense pleasure. The wanting mind can gravitate towards anything, usually pleasant experiences, whether they're gross or subtle. And it isn't actually any better to cling a new model Saab than it is an old used Ford Fiesta. It isn't much better to cling the bliss of meditative deep concentration than the mundane pleasures of ice cream. Pleasant states are not the benchmark of a good practice. Pleasant states simply arise due to conditions. There may be simple neutrality, or there may be unpleasant experiences as well. But if we're not clinging, then the conditions for suffering don't occur. Although a situation may be unpleasant, there can be peace and freedom in it as well, just as the students in the pain class learned. It doesn't matter what we don't grasp. The wanting mind can never be fulfilled. There is a legend in the Buddhist discourses where Mara, who's considered the personification of hindrances, of temptations, of doubt, of fear, of any obstructive force, any hindering force. Mara once came and taunted the Buddha and said, "If you're so enlightened, why don't you turn the Himalaya into gold?" And the Buddha replied, "Even if all the mountains on earth were turned into gold, it would not be enough to satisfy one man's greed." So there's attachment to sense pleasures. The second arena for attachment is to views and opinions, and this is the arena for clinging that occurs within our own minds, our own ideas, our views and opinions. It's amazing to observe views and opinions, because even if we don't know anything at all in our own experience about a subject, we may still have a very strong opinion about it. In fact, I found most people who hold their views very strongly may never have even had the experience that they have no view about. A lot of people, actually most of my family, my mother and sister, know meditation practice. They've come to retreats and teachings. But the rest of my family has very strong opinions about what meditation is and what I do that has absolutely no basis in anything except something that they thought, based upon something that they thought, based upon something that they thought, based upon something that they thought. It has just no reality at all. And it's impossible to describe what I actually teach, what I actually do, because it makes no sense to them, because it doesn't conform to what they've already decided I do. Views and opinions close our minds, because then we're caught into a belief system, and we tend to only then let in things that confirm those belief systems. People often have very strong political views or hold ideologies very strongly or identify with political parties very strongly. And this can lead to tremendous conflict and war. It can lead to conflict in relationship. In fact, any time there's an attachment to views or opinions, there will be conflict. Are we cherishing a position of being right, even at the expense of our own peace of mind, even at the expense of the possibility of genuine learning, genuine experience? One of the great Zen masters, Benkei, said, it was great advice, he said, don't side with yourself. Don't side with yourself. Ajahn Chah from Thailand said, the greatest hindrance is views and opinions. The greatest hindrance is views and opinions. And he used the illustration that if you have a cup filled with dirty water, you have to empty it first in order to put in clean water that you can drink. As long as we're filled with views and opinions, there isn't the space to learn. There are several discourses in the of the Buddha that describe times when somebody came to him in a very argumentative mode, intent on arguing anything that he said. And he basically said that it was that there was no point in speaking to this person. He turned away, he walked away. And then when asked afterwards by Ananda, well, why didn't you speak to him? He said, If the mind is closed, there's no space for the Dhamma. This is a gross paraphrase. This is not a quote. But he was describing the mind being closed, that there wasn't space to then hear the teachings. And he said, if somebody is inclined to argumentation, then there's no possibility of hearing the Dhamma. Sometimes we discover our views and opinions in conversations because we discover what views we hold when we are in interaction with somebody who holds different views. And it's actually a lovely thing to have friends who disagree with you, because then we see, we get a mirror outside of another way of seeing the world, another perspective on the world. Very often our own minds are chattering to us. It's worth looking into what our minds are saying, because sometimes we keep repeating our own perspective. We keep telling ourselves what to think. We keep telling ourselves what we should do. We keep telling ourselves what's right. But do we actually know what we should do? Do we actually know what is right? Can we sometimes listen to that as just a voice? And then connect with something that is simple, that is real, that is present. And let intuitive wisdom from a deeper place, not the voice of you should or the voice of conforming, tell us what to do. But let that voice touch something deeper, an intuitive wisdom that touches something deeper than the voice that conforms to the various views and opinions that we've picked up along the trail of life. One interesting thing about views and opinions is they feel very static because they're a concept. It's like a snapshot of a story, and so there can be this weird sense of security because we can grasp them. I have a position, I know what's right. And there's this strange illusion of being secure in holding a view because it's a snapshot, a quick, short experience. It's always interesting to me, though, as fiercely as people may hold views and opinions, they too change. I've had discussions with people, and over the course of a conversation, say we're talking for an hour or so, their view or my view may have changed slightly, may have adjusted slightly, and yet maybe the conversation is pleasant, maybe it's argumentative, but there can still be a fierce holding to the view and not even recognize how different it is an hour and a half later than it was when we started, because it's just a new snapshot and the grasping is still intact. When we work with views and opinions, we don't want to just refine and cling better views and opinions. We want to see the mind that is clinging the views and opinions and unravel the grasping. When we have a view, it may be our reality. It may genuinely be how we perceive the world, because that's based upon our conditions in the moment. But it may not be how another person perceives the world. Have you ever heard of the illustration? I haven't actually done this. Where you get three buckets of water. One is hot, one is cold, and the one in the middle is warm. And you have two people standing, each with their hands, one in the cold and one in the warm, one in the warm and one in the hot. And ask them to describe the warm water, one will say it's hot and one will say it's cold. Who's right? Very often we perceive things through a comparison, through our particular perspective. So they could argue back and forth, and they would each be saying, no, this water, we're touching the same water, this is hot, no, this is cold, no, this is hot, no, this is cold. Can we respect what is the reality of another person? Because we don't really know what's going on within another mind. There's a lovely story in the Buddhist scriptures where a group of blind people are brought to encounter an elephant. And one by one, they're led up to the elephant and are touching the elephant. One is touching the trunk and says, an elephant is just like a hose. Another one is touching the tail and says, no, no, an elephant is just like a broom. And another is touching the foot and says, no, the elephant is just like the stump of a tree. Another is touching the ear. Each place somebody is touching, each perspective provides a different view. If they're holding their view as reality, it will lead to arguments and disputes. Very often we solidify a belief or an opinion based upon things we don't know much about. We might read something on the internet and not confirm whether it's true or not, but just quote it to our friends as support for our argument. We might have hearsay or gossip and pass that along as though we know it's true, even if we've never met the people that it's about. This can be very painful because whenever we feel judged, very often the human response is to close up, is to feel hurt. And sometimes we can judge people even before we've met them, just based on something that somebody else said. I have a friend who went to a cocktail party, met somebody she'd never met before. And this woman came up to her and said, I'm so surprised. You don't seem nearly as arrogant as people say. What do you do with that? I mean, really? Now, this woman was brash enough to say it out loud, but very often that's the kind of thing that happens in our own minds. We've heard something about somebody, and then we meet them. And they may not quite be exactly the way that we thought that they were, but are we willing to completely let go of the views and opinions of other people and meet somebody fresh? Are we willing to let go of our own views and opinions that we may have about how somebody was last month or last week and meet them fresh as they are just now. I think every political leader, every actor, every performer knows that views and opinions are fragile. Sometimes they're raised up, praised, sometimes put down, blamed, sometimes fame, sometimes disrepute. Sometimes they're in favor and fashion, and then passé, forgotten. Where is the freedom in this seesaw? The Buddha said, those who grasp after views and opinions only wander about the world annoying people. The third arena for attachment is to rites and rituals. This includes conventions, customs, methods, techniques, practices. It's the arena for clinging in how we do things. It's the attachment to our routines. How strongly is the sense that you've got to do it right? You've got to do it correctly. Or you've got to have it your way. Or you've got to conform to the authority or conform to the group. The Buddhist tradition has a long tradition of investigating the attachment to rites and rituals, to methods and techniques, to religious conventions. Because the Buddha was a rather radical religious, religious might be the wrong word, recluse of his time. And he did not support many of the conventional practices that were common in his day, the fire rituals, the sacrifices. But this investigation of rites and rituals has come up in many other traditions. In the Gospels, it's said that Jesus was one day walking with his disciples through a cornfield, and they were very hungry. They hadn't eaten for a long time, and some of his disciples plucked the corn. And they were severely criticized by the lawyers of the time, because they were criticized, why did they do on the Sabbath what was not allowed? And Jesus responded by acknowledging the simplicity of their hunger. And he said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. My teacher in India, Poonjaji, used to often tell a story about this attachment to rites and rituals and how traditions get formed. And he said, he described another great monk of old, or great rishi of old, sadhu of old, who again, had very, very strong concentration. And he was adept at these absorption states where one could enter them for long periods of time, just like the guy who made tea. Not the same guy, though. So this monk liked to practice long, long periods of meditation where he would sit for long stretches in total stillness. And he would be fine, blissed out while he was in meditation. But when he would come out, he'd realize that he had all these sores on his legs because rats had come up and had gnawed on his body while he was in deep absorption. And so then he would have to wash the wounds, and infection was a problem. So he wanted to solve this problem, but he still wanted to practice these sustained states of stillness. So he had a brainstorm. He got a cat, and he tied a little leash around the cat, a little collar, and put a little post, a little stake by him when he meditated. So whenever he went into this deep concentration, a cat would be nearby, and that would keep the rats away. And it worked great, so his practice developed very strong. He ended up having lots and lots of disciples because he was such a powerful, powerful rishi of the day. And all of his disciples saw that whenever he meditated, he had a cat near him. So they thought, this is part of the technique. And so when they sat down for their 45 minutes each morning, they would bring their cat and put it by a stake next to them. Well, Over time, they had students, and they taught their students that to meditate correctly, you must get a cat and tie the collar exactly this way, with this kind of knot and this kind of this and this kind of buckle on the thing, and stake it this number of inches from this knee. And so they refined the practice. To remove rats, it's very sensible to keep a cat near you. But see what happens when a practice is taken up. A tradition gets formed. Having cats is not a sign of enlightenment. Judy gave me a lovely tour of Jerusalem just before the retreat. And one of the adventures we went on, many adventures, but we walked through a marketplace. And they were selling various accoutrements that one needs in the sukkot. Did I say it right? Sukkot. They were very meticulous. Magnifying glass. Looking at the little tops of the thing. And there were these citrus fruits called etrots. Yeah. Very, very careful inspection of these. Very careful inspection. I thought that was another. It fit in the same category of how precise do we have to be about these conventions, these rites, these rituals, these techniques. In the Buddhist tradition, it comes up in the idea of you have to do it like this. It's always confusing when I go to Zen temples. I rarely practice in Zen places, but I'm frequently asked to teach in them. And I often forget which ones I'm supposed to take my socks off on, which ones I'm supposed to keep my socks on in, and which angle I'm supposed to bow at, because in this tradition we're a lot looser about those things. Then you go to the Tibetans and you're supposed to do these certain kind of prostrations, and it really, like that's a certain kind of prostration. Then you go to the Thais and you don't do the prostrations that way at all. You do these three bows. And if they don't like the way that you bow, then they teach you how to bow again. Mm-hmm. So I kept being taught how to bow until I could, like, get the bow. Very precise. Very, very precise. Arranging an altar also. How to arrange an altar. What time of day to meditate? What direction to sleep in? How to arrange your shoes outside? All of the shoulds and should nots of spiritual practices fall into this category of attachment to rites and rituals. How attached are you to your religious routine? How attached are you to the way that you do your practice? Does it have to be in this room? Can it be under a tree? What about the work period? I haven't seen how these cooks arrange their vegetable choppings, but I've often been on the veggie chopping team at other retreat centers in the States. And at one place, they're very specific about how they like their vegetables chopped. And so the cooks come out and they demonstrate the angle at which they want the carrots chopped, the thickness at which they want the carrots chopped, and the direction, so that they're preparing a meal. They're the artists. It really is an art to cook. And so, as the assistants, as the apprentices, or the people who help the artists mix the paints, we're chopping the carrots. But it's always interesting to be on these teams of carrot choppers to see who can actually do what the cooks have asked them to do, and who has to do it different. No, it shouldn't be that thick. It should be this thin. No, it shouldn't be on the angle. It should be round. Round is better.
And so even though they have the model right in front, because at this place, they give us each a chopping board and each a knife, and we each stand in front of it. It's all very organized. And we each have a little model of our carrot in front of us. And so I'm chopping away, and I look over, and I see, oh, no, this person doesn't care. They want to do it any old way. And then this other person is being very precise about it. And this other person has decided that another way is better, that it's their way. Well, okay, it's just carrots. But again, it's a reflection on seeing how do we do things? Does it have to be this way? I know many of you have traveled. And I think traveling is one of the great ways to see how attached we are to our customs, because they just don't make sense any other place. And if we're attached to our own rituals, our own ways of doing things, even if it's how to go to the toilet, how to take a bath, how to make toast, how to make a cup of tea, different cultures, different countries have their own ways of doing these very normal things. It's lovely to travel because it asks us to free the mind from some attachment to our way, at least temporarily. The last arena for clinging is to the concept of self. Very often we gain a sense of self through identification with either our body or our mind, the sensations that we feel or the thoughts that we think. We can recognize sensations, thoughts, emotions as they arise. Do we recognize them as just simple conditions that come and go? Or do we add the extra of, this is mine, I am this kind of person. I have to have it this way, I must do it that way. The extra of identification and clinging. More subtly, we may recognize that we are aware. There is a knowing faculty present, a witness, an observer, a capacity to be mindful and aware. But are we that observer? Is that myself? Do we add the identification or just simply witness experience as it comes and as it goes? By not seeing change through our life, from birth to death, by not seeing how we fabricate this sense of being someone through our experience, this sense of self-grasping or self-reference position, we create this self-reference position through many of the stories that we weave about our lives. And then when we don't see how we create this self-reference, this sense of self, we end up living in our projections. Instead of living our lives, we're living the idea of our lives, the story of our lives, the tale of our lives, just a little bit removed from our own intimacy with being. The illustration of a rainbow is often used to describe the emptiness of self and the grasping of self. Because a rainbow appears due to causes and conditions in the sky. There's actually nothing there. There's nothing to hold. There's nothing to grasp. There's no paint that is thrown into the sky. It just arises due to causes and conditions, and it disappears due to causes and conditions. Sensations, thoughts, and emotions are known. They arise, they appear, they are known. But known by what? There may be nothing to find, just as the rainbow is empty. And yet knowing is happening. They are perceived. By cultivating mindfulness, we're practicing observing the flow and the change of empty experience, empty phenomena as it flows by. We are consciously practicing the art of not clinging anything. We're familiarizing ourselves with the experience of openness, of clarity, of freedom, and of release, with the experience of emptiness, the nature of mind. The Buddha was asked by Ananda one time, when Ananda saw two people having a very similar experience, and yet one passed very quickly, and the other one had a transformation of awakening. Ananda asked the Buddha, why is one person enlightened and another not? And the Buddha said, one who is without clinging attains nirvana. One who is without clinging is free. The Buddha described the way and offered the teachings, but we each must practice non-clinging for ourselves. Many of the discourses of the Buddha end with the encouragement, there are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. Let's sit for a few minutes.